Dirty Street Chambers in London, one of the leading human rights and crime sets, talking with Kirsty Romero, QC, and Francis Fitzgibbon, QC, about human rights. The rule of law in this country is based on a bedrock of various legal structures and content, but human rights is very much at the centre of that foundation. Arguably, and we'll discuss this later in the podcast, it's under threat by a government that perhaps seems unenthusiastic about complying with our obligations under the European Convention. And there are proposals, which we're also going to discuss, for a Bill of Rights to replace the Human Rights Act. Good afternoon, Kirsty.
Good afternoon.
Francis, thanks very much indeed for inviting me over and spending time to do this. What are human rights for the benefit of our non-lawyer listeners?
Well, human rights are rights which are bestowed on people as a human being. So they're really as simple as that. And they fall into different categories. The ones that are the most fundamental ones are ones where there's a positive obligation upon the state to actually protect a human right. So you'll hear, for example, right to life. So it's a basic, as a person, I have a right to live.
Yes.
And nobody has any right to kill me. There's other rights which are then qualified rights. So legislation can be brought in, so it's not an absolute right.
Can I quote Lord Bingham's words about this from his excellent book, The Rule of Law, which I recommend to anyone with even a passing interest in the subject. He says this: "The rule of law requires that the law afford adequate protection of fundamental human rights. It is a good start for public authorities to observe the letter of the law, but not enough if the law in a particular country does not protect what are there regarded as the basic entitlements of a human being." So that's where it flows from. It flows from decisions about what are the basic entitlements of a human being.
Yes, I think it was Lord Bingham, wasn't it, who came back to the riposte when people were criticising the Human Rights Act. So which particular human rights would you like to lose? Which is really an unanswerable point.
Yes.
It all really started, I suppose, in focus terms, after the Second World War with the European Convention, which is quite separate from the European Union. It's the Council of Europe, and the establishment of the European Court of Human Rights. Give us an overview, if you could, of the structure of that convention.
Well, the principal architects of the convention were the British and the French negotiators, and they brought with them the common law tradition from Britain of respect for individuals, respect for property, maintaining a distance between the individual and the state, individual liberty. The French brought with them the concepts deriving from the Declaration of Human Rights under the French Revolution. And those two traditions were blended with others, but principally those two, to form the articles of the 1950 Convention.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, Francis, it is quite interesting what you ask as to where this all comes from, because I think people lose sight of the history, and it all came about after two world wars, where basically all the nations just said, never again, we don't want another Holocaust. So you got the Universal Declaration, first of all, in 1948, and then the European Convention was ratified in 1951. So we're going, it's not a new concept, we're going back that far. And I think whereas the UN very much sort of dropped the human rights baton under the Human Rights Commission, which was an abject failure, the European Court has been a success, which is why it's puzzling in some ways as to why it's battered so much in our press.
Yes, well, it's one of the things we're going to discuss later.
It's also a nonsense to describe it, as it often is by people who should know better, as a foreign court. It's not a foreign court, it's an international court to which Britain is one of the signatories. It would be just as absurd to describe the World Cup as a foreign football tournament. as if the British team, if it didn't like the referee's decision, could say, right, we're just carrying on anyway, we're not going to respect your decision, we'll do it our way. It would make a nonsense of, that sort of international gathering, and it's a nonsense to say of the European, of the Strasbourg court, that it is a foreign court. The fact that it's in Strasbourg is an accident of history. It could be in London, and it would have exactly the same functions.
We've made a fair contribution to the convention. I think one of our people actually is principal draftsman on Maxwell Fife.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Later a Tory Home Secretary.
Yeah. And of course, actually quite interesting. quite interesting as well was the recent examination of any reforms took place in Brighton. You know, so it's not all actually happening in some far-flung jurisdiction at all.
And we've contributed a number of good judges as well, I understand.
I was at Bratz's dinner about a month ago, and he was an absolute phenomenal judge, and one we should be very proud of. And I read some interviews at the time when he became president of the court, so 2011, he was the British judge who was president. And instead of it being praise that there it was, our British judge in charge, which is what everybody wanted, there were sort of snipey kind of articles about his background as to whether he was British enough. It was absolutely ridiculous. Phenomenal, phenomenal brain.
This is what we face. We have a problem in this country. The press are antagonistic, or sections of the press are antagonistic towards the Act, and the politics really can drive a wedge between reason.
It's impossible to talk about the Human Rights Act and about human rights in this country without talking about politics and the media and the interaction between the two. But it's remarkable, I think, that since it came into force in 2000, virtually no significant politician has stood up and said it's a good thing and worth having. It's almost an embarrassment to the people in charge.
Yeah, although I think Dominic Grieve, to be fair to him, has actually said publicly that it is not an option for us to withdraw. So he's come out and said that, which is of some comfort. I don't know what Grayling's position is at present.
It's very difficult to assess. He hasn't got a legal background. And we can go on and look at the judicial review plans later as an example, because that affects human rights as well. We've got the Human Rights Act, which you just referred to, and there are proposals at present to introduce a British Bill of Rights. Do we actually need one? Haven't we got one?
Yeah.
Isn't the Human Rights Act effectively a British Bill of Rights in constitutional law?
Yes, it is. And so is the Convention of Human Rights. Again, it comes back to Lord Bingham's question, which of them would you like to lose?
Yeah. Well, I suppose they could add to them, but I think with my cynical hat on, that is perhaps unlikely.
I think it's quite interesting, actually, in terms of adding, because I do a lot of work I practice internationally, and so you get to deal with many different international charters and conventions, and obviously dealing with the European Convention. And I think one thing that actually comes across is that the European Convention and the European Court have been a success, and in fact the Court is a victim of its own success, and so that's why it's got a backlog of 138,000 cases at the moment. African Charter on Human and People's Rights actually adds more than our European Convention, that it gives specific third generation rights, which is very advanced. So that is something that could be added to the European Convention. I doubt it will. But the difficulty with the African Charter is it restricts everything in accordance with law. So if a dictator in power decides that there can only be one party and no contested elections, that's in accordance with the law. So it's tough in lack of compliance with in terms of compliance with the African Charter. So it is a big success. The Privy Council also has been a big success. The Inter-American Court is patchy, so we should really be saying, we do have a British Bill of Rights already within the Human Rights Act.
Well, it's a pretty obvious question. Why are they tinkering with it? What is the purpose of a new Bill of Rights?
Well, it's never been completely explained. There's a political motivation behind it. Quite what it is, I wouldn't like to guess, but the commission that's examining whether to introduce it published their second consultation paper last summer. I think the consultation's now closed, so listeners have missed the boat if they want to contribute. But it's an interesting document and worth looking at. And it asks a number of questions, including whether a British Bill of Rights should introduce a different set of rights over and above those that are in the European Convention, including a right to equality before the law, a right to administrative justice, which ties in with something in the European Union's Charter of Fundamental Rights, which perhaps we can talk about in a moment. It also asks whether trial by jury should be enshrined as a right. There are others, include victims' rights, various socioeconomic rights, children's rights, environmental rights. So at least on the table, they have a wide range of other proposals to include. And it's almost as though, perhaps in a very British way, they're building a constitution bit by bit without any grand overall plan. And we may end up with something that looks like a basic law, a constitutional document, giving a near exhaustive list of citizens' rights.
Could it be argued, therefore, that the politicians are gearing up to say, well, this new Bill of Rights effectively is better than the Human Rights Act, it's better than the European Convention, it's so effective, we don't actually need to be part of the European Convention. There are political problems there, but I mean, is that an arguable proposition?
I think the thing they really dislike is Strasbourg.
Yeah.
And they either through conviction or because they think it pays politically, that there's a lot of hostility to Strasbourg, which we saw most recently in the Abu-Qatada business, where there was strenuous criticism about the actually rather modest final decision that Strasbourg took about...
A fairly big margin of appreciation. We're going to look at Qatar briefly in a moment anyway. I mean, Kirsty, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it seems to me it's a very good political football, and the British Bill of Rights looms large whenever there's an election. Mm. And then it certainly slips out off my radar. Now, in terms of proposing further socioeconomic rights, well, I don't think anyone's going to particularly resist that. Now, query whether you need that all because of the domestic legislation. I simply don't know the detail of what's been proposed there. But in terms of being part of a convention, a treaty, an international treaty, I think the world moved on some time ago from small island politics, and we are part of a 47 member state. The European Court services millions, 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 millions of people, and it has pronounced some quite incredible judgments in respect of right to life. It's dealing with cases of historic genocide against the Soviet Politburo, for example. That's just gone to the Grand Chamber.
Yes.
So it's not only is it not letting these states and people in power get away with mass murder, it's setting out a whole international rule of law that we should be proud to be part of. So obviously, yes, we have our domestic legislation, but to say we want a British Bill of Rights and then withdraw from the European Convention appears to have absolutely no logic to it. And I don't think that's anything that has been proposed directly by a politician.
Well, there was a debate on Newsnight last night. Some of our listeners may have caught it. Should we stay in or come out of the European Union? And we seem to be moving closer and closer to a referendum. I suspect with a referendum, the majority will be to come out. That doesn't mean it's the right decision, of course. Francis?
Well, coming out of the European Union doesn't necessarily mean coming out of the European Convention, because the signatories to the Convention are not confined to members of the Union. So countries like Russia and Belarus are signatories to the Convention, but not members of the Union. And it's very important that countries where human rights are respected and honoured, such as in our country, remain part of the broader community of countries that subscribe to the Convention, because, maybe this is optimistic, but nevertheless, at some level, we can contribute to a culture of human rights that one hopes would eventually filter down to places where they're not respected, as in Russia and in Belarus.
Let's focus in on this. The converse, of course, is that if we came out of the European Convention, it might put our membership of Europe in some difficulty, the European Union. And it's my understanding that new applicants to the European Union, which may, of course, include an independent Scotland, will have to comply with the European Convention as part of their obligation under the European Treaty.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But I haven't heard any proposal about coming out of the European Convention, although I accept your point. If it was to go to a referendum, I think possibly whipped up by misinformation, which I think is the key, then people might vote on the misinformation. I mean, the actual facts are that I think in 2011, it's something like eight in 1,000 cases where there's been findings against the UK government. It's not that Strasbourg is constantly finding against the UK government. The law develops. There's all sorts of findings that people don't like within the UK, and that's the law.
We've actually got quite a good record of compliance.
Very good record.
Yes. One of the best.
Yeah.
And it's just the hard cases, which we're going to have a quick look at in a moment, that cause the tabloids to be exercised. But
can I say a word about
yes,
the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which was a wider ranging instrument than the convention? A lot of it is overlapping, but it includes some of the rights that I mentioned a moment ago that they're talking about putting into a British Bill of Rights. It was ratified in the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, and it applies to all but only members of the European Union, so it doesn't include the wider group of countries that subscribe to the convention. Britain and Poland negotiated an exemption from the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which means that in neither country can the citizen go to court and take a case on the basis that his charter rights have been interfered with in some way by the government or a public body. So they've already negotiated their way out of that one. And I don't know if that would somehow be, that exemption would serve as some sort of precedent for opting out of all or part of the European Convention.
Yeah.
Can we turn to look at some of the hard cases? We've mentioned Qatar already. Just if you could, or Francis, both of you, just take us through the basic problem of the Qatar judgment for the government.
Yes, well, I think it's obviously a problem for the government, but I think it's actually a problem for all of us in terms of how long it's gone on. Mm. So I don't think there's many people who will say this is a great success case. But he was somebody who was detained without charge for many years. I think 9 years in total he spent in prison without charge. Now, that's a failing on our part with our various control orders and methods of detaining people without actually collating the evidence, putting in a public prosecution. So SIAC has already publicly condemned the amount of time that this case has taken. In terms of what happened, ironically, the government in January had a big success in its decision, and I'm not quite sure where that got lost in the publicity. It won in Strasbourg on its major argument that, in fact, Abu Qatada would not be ill-treated if he was returned to Jordan. So the government won on that major plank. However, Strasbourg did rule that there was a danger, there was a real risk that evidence obtained by torture would be used against him. Now, they then set into train a series of unfortunate events, including a premature announcement which everyone remembers, that there's no appeal, he's now going to be on a plane very soon. And of course, the appeal then went in that evening. So then there was a debate about whether it was April the 16th or April the 17th that was the deadline. But anybody sensible is, when you're dealing with somebody's liberty and looking at convention rights, there's always going to be a discretion of a day if there's any dispute over it. So obviously he was not going to be barred on the time, but obviously as well he wasn't going to win because of it, and it wasn't referred to the Grand Chamber because of other judgments that had gone on. So there was no real fear, I don't think, by that appeal. However, what's now happened is that SIAC has considered that the from considering the evidence, including given by lawyers from Jordan, that there is a real risk that the evidence obtained by torture will be used in a trial. And as far as I understand it, there's been quite a lot of conflict from the lawyers in that they can't actually guarantee and say this evidence, which was, and there's evidence of torture all over the place against these particular co-defendants when they gave evidence in court, in fact, some of it, against Abu Qatada. The lawyers are split as to whether it can be used or not. So that's where it is at the moment. Now, the government's applied to for leave to appeal was refused at SIAC and is now applying to have leave to the High Court. It seems as to whether they'll get it or not, we'll have to wait and see. But they're basically saying that the SIAC judge, the High Court judge, applied the wrong test in considering the risk of torture evidence as to how sure the court has to be, that sort of test. So that's where we're at.
It's
with got
to be on a point of law.
It has to be a point of law.
Yes, absolutely. But the actual decision gave the British government a fair margin, did it not? I mean, they can go back to Jordan and get Jordan to change the law.
Well, they've already been doing that, of course.
Yes,
I mean, they back and forth, and they had a memorandum of understanding. But it's pretty obvious that Abu Qatada is not going to be accepting that it's worth the paper it's written on. And with some justification. I mean, Jordan has a horrific record of human rights violations. And that is the problem dealing with states such as Jordan. And it makes it a very hard case. But I would rather live in a country where it deals with a hard case like Abu Qatada and will make a strong ruling, which is unpopular, saying at present we are not satisfied that this man will not be will not have a fair trial, which is what it was found to be a violation of his Article 6 rights. And it's how the law develops. And it's interesting from a legal perspective. It's very frustrating from a citizen's perspective. And I have the frustrated hat on as well, obviously.
Yes.
But I think the decision was the right one, and we have to respect it.
It's the difficulty, I think you've identified it precisely, is that these hard cases attract the attention of the press. They attract particularly the attention of the politically motivated press, so you get a polarisation of view, and it to some extent poisons people's perception of how valuable this act is. Francis?
Yeah, I've got two comments really. The fundamental question is one of values. It's do we think that this is a country in which we should be sending people abroad to face trial under a system in which torture is regularly used to obtain evidence? Now, if we feel comfortable with doing that, fine, let's do it. But if we think that's actually not a good thing to do, and sends out a bad message to other countries who are less scrupulous in their adherence to what we regard as basic principles, then it is not a good thing to do, and we should not be doing it. And the second thing is this. Let's say we come out of the European Convention system, and we had an entirely isolated system of Bill of Rights or whatever, and a bearded bogeyman of some description came before the courts in similar circumstances. Mm. Well, British judges might come to exactly the same conclusions, even without the superstructure of Strasbourg over them. And you can bet your life that the politically motivated press would have a field day in exactly the same way as they do now, because as we all know, there's nothing they like better than to have a go at judges and what they regard as outrageous decisions. And it's, you see it not only in the context of human rights, you see it a lot in criminal law, where judges and defence lawyers are pilloried for doing their job and upholding the rule of law by fulfilling their functions.
We're going to have a look at the Finucane case in a moment. But it's somewhat ironic that the more extreme elements of the press are praying in aid, Article 10, in connection with human rights in relation to the Leveson inquiry.
Absolutely. I mean, it can't be a pick and choose on fundamental rights. I mean, there was also, of course, Gary McKinnon.
Yeah.
And that case was supported, in fact, by the Daily Mail, by Paul Dacre in particular.
Yes.
And what he was supporting there was the application of the Human Rights Act in that case.
Yeah.
And that's what won that case. But I didn't notice a headline in the Daily Mail about the triumph of the Human Rights Act. And that's a shame, because it's an important case, a difficult case also, and the law was applied in a way...
Well, that's really where I put the question, is it poisoning the public perception of human rights, because the press are not lauding where they get a victory and bring it down to the Human Rights Act. But another very difficult case, which I've covered many times with Carl Gardner and others, is prisoner votes, because instinctively, I suspect if you ask the ordinary member of the public outside, do you think prisoners should have votes, they'll probably say no. A significant proportion of them, without really thinking about it, down to instinct. But I mean, our judgment has been all the way through the system in this country and in Europe, and yet still the government is messing around, arguably.
Well, they were told in 2005 that they had to get on and act on the judgment when it was first given, and there's been a lot of foot dragging. Foot dragging is not my word. Foot dragging is the expression used by Viviane Reding, the European Commissioner for Justice and Human Rights, who in a speech last week. Perhaps showing remarkable lack of diplomacy for someone in her position, but nevertheless, so the British government was dragging its feet over matters of human rights.
Yeah.
So there you are. Again, I think it's a matter of values, fundamentally. Do we think that prison should be more than simply taking away somebody's liberty to go where they choose? Should it contain additional punitive elements, such as removal of pretty basic civil right to vote? Now, you could say that is a purely political decision. That's a decision that should be reached by democratic process, by public opinion, by votes, by political will, rather than by the court. And that's... I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think with that, I think the fundamental is that there's a judgment given by the European Court, and the UK has to comply with that judgment. I think that's non-negotiable, because we can't be in a position of pointing at, for example, Italy, which is a shocker at complying with judgments, which, you know, people sort of reach for Russia and countries like that, but actually Italy is a big offender. We can't point the finger at those countries if we pick and choose which judgments we want to comply with. Now, my understanding is that there's a bill in relation to prisoners' votes going through Parliament, but my understanding also is that it's a bill which is probably not going to pass. Now, that is a way, obviously, of complying with the judgment of Strasbourg, but at least there is some movement within the legislature.
But again, we reasonable margin of appreciation there in terms of how we apply it, and I haven't said you must give all prisoners.
Yes.
You can exclude certain categories.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that it is important, the margin of appreciation. I mean, as a lawyer, I come across this quite often, and it's very frustrating as a lawyer that the margin of appreciation is applied. And is brought in arguments against me all the time. So it is actually quite a wide, it's a wide discretion there that is given to the state to comply. And it's not right that Strasbourg is overreaching and interfering in domestic affairs. It simply doesn't do that.
I saw a very interesting short film on YouTube with Nick Phillips, the then President of the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice, Lord Judge, where they were discussing the relationship between the Supreme Court and the European Court of Human Rights. How would you sum it up, and the interplay between the two, and which one is sovereign?
Well, I'm not sure you can say that, it's a matter of sovereignty exactly, because the Human Rights Act requires all British courts to take account of its judgments, and that's a very pregnant phrase, take account of. There are those who think that that means they should be treated as almost as precedents, so that they're binding on our courts, which would include the House of Lords, the Supreme Court, I should say. And there are those who think that take account of means less than a binding precedent, and it's simply one of the factors that British courts should take into account when, should have regard to when making their own decisions. I think probably the general view is that they are of extremely strong persuasive force when it comes to British courts. But I think it's difficult to look at it in terms of supremacy or sovereignty. It doesn't quite work that way. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that, Francis. I think there appeared to at one point be a little bit of a power tussle going on between the Supreme Court and the European Court. But in terms of the judgments from Strasbourg and the judgments from the Supreme Court, they're all very detailed, reasoned jurisprudence. And I think the Supreme Court certainly does take account of Strasbourg as it ought to do, and it seems that I certainly don't think that the Supreme Court is bowing to a sort of different type of sovereignty. But what I also think is very interesting is that the European Court, even where it is not of any particular, not of any binding authority in other countries, for example, in Latin America and in Africa. Those countries look to the jurisprudence of Strasbourg and use its decisions to try and persuade their judges and their courts in applying their own convention and charter rights. So it is good law, and I think in this country we sort of respect the development of law, and I think that was working quite well.
Well, it's clearly, I mean, the convention itself has clearly shaped jurisprudence in this country, and the interplay, that's why I was asking the question, I think has been very significant. And that was really the point that Lord Phillips was saying, that we are bound to take account of them, but we have a very good range to take into account our own needs as well, which I think is quite a diplomatic and diplomatic answer.
I think one of the criticisms that you hear about the Strasbourg decisions is that they, and I don't know if it's justified or not, but what people say is that they're too particularised, and that the real job of the court is to give fairly broad statements of principle on human rights matters rather than to drill down into very specific decisions. And I think some of the criticism of the prisoner votes case is on that basis, that it's gone beyond its own remit. It's got too involved in the very specific issues that cases raise. Now, I don't know whether that's true without having a much more extensive knowledge of the range of decisions than I've got, but I know that's what is sometimes said. And it may be that the interplay works at a level, or should work at a level of principle rather than of actual hard facts of cases.
You mentioned earlier, Kirsty, that we're 138,000 cases behind the European Court of Human Rights. Justice delayed is sometimes said to be justice denied. I mean, it's an old aphorism, but can anything really be done to speed things up? Not only in Europe, but also in our own country. This came up in Qatar, 10 years.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I think it's money, I'm afraid, is what it all comes down to, because certainly in Brighton, when there was the meeting earlier this year, to consider reforms for the European Court. There was different systems considered, such as, you know, how to perhaps deal more efficiently with applications which are inadmissible, because some applications will be returned and then they'll come back several times, and so can you restrict them coming back? And there was some consideration of the US system, but the difficulty is that with a lot of the cases that go to the European Court, particularly those coming from Turkey and Russia, they don't have the luxury or the basic right of going through a local court like they will do in the US, where therefore they can be much more robust in picking and choosing what then moves on to the higher court. So I don't think any way of approaching it in terms of filtering it, there's any other way than the way it's working now, other than there needs to be more staff, there needs to be more people to deal with it, which is back to money.
It's logistics and money.
Yeah.
But maybe the future will bring a change there. Can I just touch on a hobby horse of mine, that we do enjoy international relations, and it's perhaps time for Britain to project soft power rather than hard military power. And one of the things that we can do, and I know you're involved in this field, is actually assist countries abroad in establishing, you know, good practices. Relationship between the bar and foreign bars has been a long tradition. And it could almost go so far as to say, I suspect, the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, would regard human rights as a fundamental platform of his own foreign policy in this country. Are we in danger, possibly, of shooting ourselves in the foot with all this political stuff?
Yes, I think you raise a very good point. And as you said, I do a lot of work internationally and a lot of work on behalf of the Bar Human Rights Committee, which is focused on training, working alongside lawyers, working alongside judges, and also working with NGOs, civil society. And those people are people who, for various reasons, don't have access to the court, or are under threat, who are killed, who are fighting against impunity. And we, as UK lawyers, are going along there to say this is what we do in our system, and also pointed to UN mechanisms to say this is what you can do in order to access some sort of justice. And the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is very much behind that. Human rights is also a big player on the international field. Barack Obama, when he came into power, made it clear to Colombia, for example, that they had to clean up their Human Rights Act before the economic policies could continue.
Yeah.
President of Colombia, President Santos, when he was over here at the beginning of the year, was standing next to David Cameron, and the two of them were talking about human rights and what they were doing and what the UK government was doing for human rights in Colombia. So it's rather ironic to see our Prime Minister making those sort of statements.
Right.
And then the next day you might pick up a newspaper where there is some berating of the Human Rights Act. It marks us out as an international player, respected player, how we treat our people.
Well,
and we shouldn't be ashamed of that.
I was going to say that if it's done with conviction and sincerity, then it's something that we should be very proud of. But it's certainly not matched by this government's attitude to access to justice of people in the UK, which is being severely restricted for all sorts of things.
I'd like to touch on that in a moment, but just by way of illustration, following up on both your points, I've spent 25 years of my life teaching students, many of whom from foreign jurisdictions, and I think the contribution that English law has made in terms of education, in terms of values, to overseas jurisdictions is quite well known. I remember talking to the Sultan of Perak, who used to be the Lord Chief Justice and Lord President of the Malaysian Supreme Court, Raja Azlan Shah, and he said, "Mike, it's very important that we send our students to Britain, even though we can educate them here for the practice courses and indeed the degree, because we want them to be influenced by British justice systems. We'd like it to be 100% Westminster was the phrase he used, which is somewhat ironic, but he predated the present coalition.
Mm.
That shows you what an asset it is that we have such an internationally respected system of justice.
Well, I did a podcast with Toby Craig at the Bar Council recently to answer a number of rather difficult questions, which he actually answered rather well. But I said that the work of the various chairs of the Bar Council is just as important abroad as it is here, almost, and in some respects more important, because the international dimension, quite apart from the commercial value to this country of the new court in Qatar and the various mediation mechanisms being set up abroad, staffed by British judges. In fact, I think Lord Phillips has gone to Qatar, hasn't he, to head it up. A nice one if you can get it. But I think he's earned it.
Yes.
He's earned his place in the sun. In terms of what you think, barristers particularly, because they seem to be heading the initiative for overseas connections, perhaps more so than the Law Society. I will ask the Law Society what they're doing. But what do you think barristers particularly can do with lawyers overseas?
I think, in terms of what the Bar Human Rights Committee has been doing, we carry out trial observations, and that is usually at the invitation of local NGOs and also local lawyers, where the position is just too dangerous for them to become involved. And it provides also support for the lawyer who is representing the particular defendant in court. And it provides real life and death difference support. So those cases, and there's been a number ongoing, particularly in Bahrain in recent years and also in Turkey, those cases are very important. We also carry out training in partnership with the International Senior Lawyers Project, which is UK and US based of solicitors, and that is training at the law school in Tanzania criminal practice procedure. But also, I think specifically with lawyers overseas is work in Nigeria, for example. It's so hard there, where they have a case and there's a grieving family. Say a child has been killed, having been accused of being a witch. And there's many yes. cases mm. where this has happened, or there's an allegation that this has happened. And then the system doesn't move. That there are reports of police expecting money before they will investigate. You have a poor family.
No.
There are reports then of just simply nothing happening within the court. So that is where international lawyers can come in to provide assistance, to actually try and assist the lawyers on the ground to get these cases moving so that there is justice and so that these awful crimes stop.
Francis?
I was talking, this happens earlier today, to a former judge from Zimbabwe who had to leave because the politics were too dangerous, and he came here as an asylum seeker and was granted refugee status here. And we were talking about this very point, and he said that one of the great things that a foreign lawyer can do in a place like that is intervene in a human rights case and be safe and not be taken out of the back and shot, as might happen to a local lawyer. So that is of huge importance
Can I just give you one example? It's just to me quite an uplifting example this year, and it also shows how politics also interlinks with the law. Ralph Kasambara, who is a human rights lawyer, activist, former Attorney General in Malawi.
Yeah.
He was arrested and detained. I don't need to go into the detail of it. He was arrested for assault. He had another story. This was a political setup, effectively. But he was detained. But in any event, the magistrate granted him bail, but he was not released. And they then went to the High Court with his local lawyers, who issued an order that he had to be released immediately. He still wasn't released. We intervened from the UK by supporting the local lawyers, contacting the UN Special Rapporteur, going on the world media, and basically challenging the authorities as to why he hadn't been released from prison. He was then released, and subsequently, within 4 weeks, because the president died, I think he had a heart attack, the whole regime changed, and he's now Attorney General and Minister of Justice. So he went from being unlawfully detained to being the Attorney General within a period of weeks. And much of the international intervention, I think, certainly from reports we got from Malawi, helped sort of stabilise what was going on, because the situation could easily have imploded. And that was a great thing to do, just to try and use the international law to assist those who were really struggling, not knowing who was going to be arrested next.
Well, by way of closing, bring to an end and running off a fascinating discussion, access to justice is a fundamental human right.
Yes, it's not much use having legally enforceable rights if you can't get into court to get someone to stand up for them. And I think what we're seeing at the moment here is a matter of absolute policy. An erosion of poor people's ability to go to court and assert their, not just their human rights, but their legal rights in general.
So, I mean, this is LASPO, legal aid, and
This is restrictions to legal aid under LASPO, which hits an enormous swathe of people who are being told, well, if you can't afford a lawyer, go and do it yourself. Which is all very well, but the cases that LASPO excludes are often ones where the law is extremely complicated. Aspects of family law or social security law or housing law, these things are really difficult. And the lawyers find them difficult.
Well, legal aid isn't being restricted to the government lawyers, is it? They'll still be briefed.
The government will, when it on occasion, the government will pay for the best people it can get. And it may be they offer a discount, but nevertheless.
I have to think of David and Goliath, but it's not a fair fight, really, is it? Because the self-represented litigant, as we must now call them, apparently, is really at a disadvantage.
Yes.
And, you know, fundamental rights are being denied in crime, in family law, particularly in the more vulnerable sections of the community. And this isn't making a political point. I mean, these are human points. And we need to, you know, the budget isn't particularly large. I mean, the press keeps referring to the fact the Ministry of Justice is saying that it's one of the biggest legal aid budgets in the world. But what sort of country do we want to live in? I think echoing your points earlier.
The statistics are very contested because the comparisons are often with countries in which the costs are hidden. For example, in countries where there's an inquisitorial system, where a lot of the cost is borne by the court rather than by the lawyer by pay for the lawyers. So you're not comparing like with like a lot of the time. And actually, I think it's a good thing that we are prepared to spend money so that the citizen can get lawyers to represent him or her in court. Yes. I think that's something we should be proud of.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that just the personal aspect of dealing, I mean, many people at Doughty Street, and I think probably both of us here, we've worked in these sort of places like Citizen Advice Bureau places, which will be no more. And the vulnerability of people who are disempowered through their living conditions, through their lack of knowledge in terms of the law. And it, as you say, it's not just David and Goliath. It's just completely wrong, basically. And there has been the House of Lords. There was a certainly was it Lord Bulch who resigned. I think he called the reforms bordering on the positively evil.
Yes.
So it brought very strong. And Lord Panic was somebody else who came out against what was going on, because to treat people who are quite often at the bottom of the heap to start off with, to treat them in a way that they can see no way out through access to the courts.
Yeah.
I would echo that is positively evil.
We've got another illustration of the Jackson reforms with the personal injury world. I mean, it's argued that, you know, personal injury lawyers are going to be decimated. I wouldn't, and I think Neil Rose made this point in legal futures, I certainly wouldn't like to take a case on my own on personal injury matters because they're quite complex, especially if I'm up against an insurance company that has got experienced counsel.
Well, litigation is quite frightening if you're put in that position, and it's usually at moments of, you know, complete stress for people. And so they are entitled to have a lawyer. Now we should be ranking access to justice up there alongside the NHS.
Well, you're both crime and human rights lawyers. It must be pretty frightening to someone in a police station if they can't get access to decent legal representation, if they're not regulars down at the custody suite.
I think it must be terrifying being locked in a cell.
Yeah.
And maybe you get access to someone down the phone.
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's great, but it's sort of hollowing out the valuable tradition that this country has of respecting rule of law if you make law inaccessible to people.
Mm.
And that it has all sorts of fairly obvious knock-on consequences for the reputation abroad. On a more mundane level, where you've got the courts filled up with people representing themselves, it's going to take time. So everybody else has to wait. So the queues get longer, the waits get longer. As we said before, justice delayed is not a good thing, whatever your case.
Mm. I think the other point as well is no doubt... Some people perhaps listening to this will say, oh, it's just lawyers arguing about fees. But I think the fact is it's not, because the fact with these reforms, these cuts, there were so many charities, NGOs, Shelter, for example, came out against it. So it's not about lawyers' fees. It really is about access to justice.
Young criminal lawyers
tell me
that they're not earning very much money at all, you know, at the younger bar.
It was a very cynical thing for Ken Clark to say, oh, it's only lawyers who care about this. It's just not true.
Mm.
I went to a public conversation, or semi-public conversation, between him when he was still the minister and Roger Smith of Liberty in the summer. And
justice. Clark...
Justice, thank you.
Justice,
And Clark was talking in his delightfully avuncular way about himself and his life and what he stood for and so on.
Yeah.
And it was great. But when he actually was asked some questions about what was really going on, he made it very clear. He said that, as a matter of policy, the government no longer thought that the public should be paying for a whole range of litigation. So it's a conscious policy decision that no, the state, the public, through taxes, will not pay for all sorts of cases that traditionally it has paid for. That is where this comes from.
Yes.
It's not just a matter of cost cutting, it's a matter of a philosophy about what the state should be doing.
Yeah. Well, some people say that a threat of legal proceedings, criminal and civil, can have just as damaging effect on a life as a serious medical condition, and if these people don't get help, it can only go one way. I'd like to thank both of you very much indeed for inviting me over today. I enjoyed that. I'm absolutely certain our listeners will. So thank you very much.
It's been lovely to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.